Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Michael Brandis, a lawyer and former counselor and senior assistant for counterproliferation policy in the Office of the Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. I will be your chair and moderator for this evening. Tonight, we present a town hall discussion that will explore from different perspectives the next steps for America's policies and presence in Iraq and the Middle East. 4 years ago, the United States of America launched a military assault against the nation of Iraq. Now, with the U.S. government divided on policy and strategic issues, Iraq is mired in a civil conflict. There is also intelligence that al-Qaeda is regrouping in other parts of the Middle East. Are we losing our way in the war on terror? What needs to be done to fix Iraq? What role does the U.S. play? How can we prevent further terrorist attacks at home? And ultimately, what needs to happen to improve the U.S. image in the Middle East? Tonight, we hope to answer some of these questions. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and invite our audience to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. Dr. James Noyes is a research fellow at the Hoover Institute who specializes in Middle East affairs. He has researched the influence of the Iraq War on evolving Middle East political conflicts. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Near Eastern, African, and South Asian Affairs in Washington, D.C. from 1970 to 1976. Dr. Mazir Behrouz is an Assistant Professor of History at San Francisco State University. Dr. Behrouz is an authority on the history of the Islamic world and current political and cultural trends. He created San Francisco State's two-part class on history of the Islamic world from the years 500 to 1500 and 1500 to today. He is the author of Rebels with a Cause, The Failure of the Left in Iran. Dr. Jeffrey Bale is an assistant professor at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Dr. Bale has been studying extremist terrorist groups for nearly two decades. He has published a number of articles on terrorism, Islamism, right-wing extremism, and covert operations. He sometimes serves as a consultant for government agencies and private organizations on matters related to terrorism and ideological extremism. And Neil McFarquhar has been the Cairo Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He is an expert in Middle East affairs who continues as a national correspondent for the Times based out of San Francisco. He writes about Muslims living in the United States and is the author of The Sand Cafe. Let's start with these questions. First, what should the next steps be for the United States in Iraq and why? I'll address the whole panel one at a time. First, Dr. Noyes.
I think the initial problem that we have to face is to disengage realistically from combat operations. This does not mean, cannot mean simply pulling up stakes and moving out. It's got to mean moving gradually, depending on how this current surge goes. I don't, so-called surge of troops, I don't see much prospect that it will allow all the divided entities to reach a political agreement, to reach a political agreement between warring parties. There has to be, you might say it would need to be a kind of clean civil war, discrete combat between two clearly defined entities. There are many, many, many groups on both the Shia and Sunni side, and for them to get together sufficiently, even within the Shia community apparently, let alone the Sunni, sufficiently to allow a full political agreement of the sort the Bush administration wants is, to me, virtually impossible. I hope I'm wrong. But we must withdraw, in one sense, out of the cities, maintaining a military presence for as long as we can do so in a hopefully a helpful mode. I don't want to go on and on.
Well, thank you. Dr. Beirouz?
Before I answer the question, I would like to think that one needs to be realistic about Iraq. And that means to me that, first of all, there is no good solution, and there is no military solution to the occupation. I think a political, and by the way, I don't think the United States just pulling out of Iraq is also a viable solution, because then the country will start an open civil war, as against what is today, which is kind of a civil war under American management. That is not a good solution. America pulling out is not a good solution. To think that this is a military victory is a solution is not a good solution. And to think that there is a good solution is I think, the wrong way to go. You have bad solutions and maybe worse solutions. I think, to answer your question regarding the next step, I think Iraq's a solution to Iraq's problem is political and military. These must go parallel to each other. American military presence right now, I think, is necessary, but not unless it is accompanied with a political process that will complement it. That political process needs to take into consideration opening dialogue with the very insurgency that the Americans are fighting. Realistic dialogue with that insurgency by identifying who the insurgency is. People are not telling us who the insurgency is. I can talk about it later on, about who exactly it is. To open dialogue with the opposition, one needs also to bring in Iraq's neighbors. Continually, for example, threatening Syria and Iran while expecting them to help America in a quagmire is not very realistic. So a political solution parallel to the military escalation seems to be the only rational next step that needs to be taken. Something that I personally, at this point, I cannot see it actually happening.
Dr. Bale?
I'm sorry to say that I agree with Dr. Beirouz almost completely. I think that the occupation of Iraq has been so catastrophically mismanaged that I just don't believe that there's really any simple solution to the problem now or any easy way out. I agree that we can't simply leave tomorrow. And at the same time, if we stay and don't improve our decision-making and put a lot of pressure on the various parties to come to a political solution, it's just not going to be there's not going to be any solution there either. One thing I think that we should have been doing all along that we failed miserably to do vis-a-vis the Sunni insurgents is to try to divide. There's lots of divisions within the Sunni between, for example, the Ba'athists, nationalist elements, and the Islamists. And one of the things that we could have done very early on was try to drive wedges between the Ba'athists and the Islamists and the nationalists and the Islamists, because the Islamists are really our enemy in this conflict against terrorist groups now. And the Ba'athists are longstanding enemies of the Islamists, and nationalist elements within the Sunni insurgency are also hostile to the Islamists, especially the foreign jihadists. So there was a real opportunity there, I think, to divide and the insurgent movement. The problem, however, is that the thing that's holding them together is the fact that, A, we're there, and we're perceived as a foreign occupier, and B, that we're not putting enough pressure on the Shia government that we've put in power, which is an Islamist government as well, unfortunately, to really make concessions to the Sunni. So the result is that we seem to be unable to divide and conquer vis-a-vis the Sunni insurgency, and until we develop more sophisticated, nuanced approaches vis-a-vis our enemies in Iraq, I don't think there's really a way forward.
Thank you. Mr. Mitfarkor?
I think we all agree that the blinding glare of the obvious, that if anybody figured out what the easy answer was, we wouldn't be sitting here. But we all agree that a military solution and trying a military surge of sending in 20,000 extra soldiers is meaningless if you don't have some sort of political process that you're trying to bolster. And so far, the U.S. has been depending on elections and thinking the elections were going to solve the problems. But elections can't happen when there isn't a civil society. You can do them. They did, and people were happy to participate. But there has to be, it has to be anchored in something, and there's nothing there. So they need to put more pressure on the political process in getting the different sides to sit down, no matter how difficult that is. And we don't see any effort on that, and the members of the parliament are often out of the country, et cetera. And the other thing, the Iraqis are incredibly technically competent people. They're really good doctors, they're good engineers, they're good artists, they're good musicians. And if given the wherewithal, you wouldn't have to have the United States in there rebuilding the place. And for that, you need security. And, it's just kind of a telling. I just saw the statistic the other day that the U.S. has spent $22 billion on rebuilding the infrastructure, and Baghdad still only gets an average of 6 hours of electricity a day. Because the insurgents would go in and they blow up the pylons and all the big electric lines feeding Baghdad from the outside. So you have to establish the conditions to a certain extent to let the Iraqis, develop their own country. And I think they really want to, and the failure to do that has made the insurgency attractive to a lot of people or caused a lot of people with talent to flee the country and, move to Syria or Jordan or wherever. So those are the two things I would say is push on the infrastructure and work on a political solution.
Thank you. I have a question for Dr. Bale, particularly due to his background on terrorism and extremist organizations. Is Iraq really the central front in the war on terror, as often cited by the White House?
Well, first of all, let's discuss the terminology. Terror is a psychological state marked by fear and anxiety, so there's no such thing as a war against a psychological state, so that's inappropriate. Terrorism is the term, the appropriate term here. Terrorism is a violent technique of psychological manipulation, but you can't actually wage a war against the technique either. You can only wage a war or a conflict against certain groups that are using the technique, and what we really should be talking about when we're talking about using the term war or conflict, the real war is against radical Islam and particularly the violence-prone networks affiliated with that milieu, and that's really what we should be openly acknowledging as the enemy here. Now, the other question is Iraq the central front? It's not the central front of the war on terrorism, but it's become a major front of the Sunni jihadist groups precisely because we eliminated Saddam's regime. If we had not eliminated Saddam's regime, there wouldn't have been jihadist bases in Iraq. That's a little bit of a simplification because even prior to our invasion and elimination or overthrow of the regime, Saddam was in fact supporting Islamist groups in Kurdistan, the group Ansar al-Islam, to make trouble for his Kurdish rivals and opponents. But still, within the central part of Iraq, under the control of the Ba'athists, there would never have been jihadist groups operating unless we had destroyed the Ba'athist regime. So to the extent that Iraq has become a front in the war on terrorism, it's a direct result of the fact that we eliminated the Ba'athist regime.
Thank you. Mr. Mitfarkor, I'd like to address the same question to you, but if you can please give a response that entails your background as being a journalist in the Middle East for quite a long time.
In terms of whether it's the front of the war on...
And also, how do the people in those countries view that notion of it being the central front in the war on terrorism?
Well, I don't think... conspiracy theories in the Middle East abound, and I don't think that anybody has really accepted the idea of, the war on terrorism. They basically see that as an excuse for the United States to kind of try and reassert colonial control, and especially as the answers as to why the United States went in have changed, because first there was this big push for, you know, it's going to be this model democracy, and when the model democracy thing, you know, didn't work, then people started at, you know, they fell back to the position that the United States is there for oil, and, you know, with the recent agreement that allows the international oil companies back in there to in the the oil agreement hasn't been hammered out completely yet, but it gives them much more favorable terms than they have in any other country in the region, then people look at that askance. And I think that because the reputation of the United States has suffered so much in the region, and because there's a strong feeling that everything we do is in support of Israel, that nobody takes at face value anything that the United States says publicly anymore. And I think that trying to rebuild that credibility is an important aspect of emerging from Iraq and in trying to sort of reassert the U.S. role as kind of an independent broker in the region.
Dr. Noyes, what tactics would you suggest the United States government utilize, if any are different than being utilized today in the war on terrorism? And I'm speaking both militarily as well as politically or diplomatically.
I think the first requirement is to develop a greater sense of nuance, which has not been a hallmark of the Bush administration in dealing with this region. We have simply said Syria is supports Hezbollah, therefore it's evil, we won't work with them. We've said that we won't. Apparently there have been fairly strong gestures from Iran over the past years of wanting to have discussions with us. We did cooperate with them, or they cooperated with us successfully during the Afghan war, the first part of it. That, I think, now is the blindingly necessary next phase, is cooperation with all sorts of entities, not political entities, not giving in to their wishes on all issues, but finding areas of agreement, going after them seriously, and without blanket assertions of some of a particular country's or even a particular political entity's total evil or incapability to cooperate.
Dr. Bibrous, you have a special expertise on Iran, and therefore the question is, what would you suggest the United States government do in trying to build a relationship with Iran?
The current government, I don't think anything can be done. They don't want to do it, and they will not do it. That's my conclusion. We have to wait for a kind of a regime change here. And the good thing is that it goes through elections, so it's a good thing that we have that option. Listen, Iran gave the United States in the year 2003 a grand bargain solution to the call to the problems. They sent it to the State Department, and they threw it into their drawer. This grand bargain solution was to solve Iran's problems with Israel, with Hezbollah in Lebanon, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan, as well as the nuclear issue and other issues with the United States. The grand bargain solution. They gave it to the Americans rejected it without even considering it. So if you ask me, I think the Iranian government has been sufficiently pressured by international pressure and by the United States. After all, there are two aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf. just outside Iran's coastline, to be willing to forego the kind of confrontation that Iraq and Afghanistan went through, and open negotiation with the United States. Because even if Iran is not occupied by the U.S., as the U.S. doesn't have the force to do it, it will be badly bruised. Nobody wants to be badly bruised if it can be prevented. So to open negotiation with the United States, I think that the Iranian side is pretty much ready, and preconditions would not help in opening negotiations. It is on the administration side that I get the sense that the readiness is not there. And as you know, the Baker-Hamilton report, which was thrown into the trash can in a way by the administration, stipulated as one of its solutions was to open up negotiations with Iran in order to find a solution to Iraq and other problems in the Middle East, and it did not happen. So I think it's healthy for both countries to do it. It must be done if Iraq is to be found a solution to the problem in Iraq, but I doubt that with the current administration it will be done.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a town hall meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our subject is the United States' future in Iraq and the Middle East. Our panelists tonight are Dr. James Noyes of the Hoover Institute, Dr. Mazir Behrouz of San Francisco State University, Dr. Jeffrey Bale of the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and Neil Mifarquhar of the New York Times. Mr. Mifarquhar, should we change our policy with respect to Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states?
I think one of the issues, and it's just not all Saudi Arabia, but it's the whole region, and I'm just going to sort of talk about one of my pet peeves, which is that the United States, when you're in the region, one of your great frustrations is that you talk to a lot of very smart American diplomats who are schooled in the region and know a lot about it, and that doesn't seem to connect very well into policy. And a friend of mine was talking the other day to a congressman who'd been on a congressional delegation to Afghanistan, and there was a big fight because a bunch of Afghan sort of feudal leaders or warlords who were allied with the United States showed up at the banquet, and they all had their gunmen and their weapons with them, and they had a lot. And so the Secret Service went a little bit crazy and said, none of you can bring your weapons in. And so there was this long process of negotiation with one of the senators. And, you know, one of the warlords steps forward and we said, you know, we appreciate everything the U.S. has done for us, but it's dangerous for us to be associated with the United States, and you're going home tomorrow, but we have to stay here and live with the consequences. And the senator's response was, we're not going home tomorrow, we're going home Wednesday. And I think that there is a certain insensitivity to conditions on the ground. Now, that being said, I've spent a lot of time talking to people trying to push for reform in those countries, and I think where the United States could do more is to kind of help the people in those countries that are trying to push for change. And I'm not saying fund them or otherwise support them so it looks like that you're trying to undermine the governments in those countries, but there are people who, you know, want different kinds of education, want more secular societies, you know, want freer elections, want more open government. And even as, you know, private citizens, you can do your bit by helping with groups with Amnesty International or things like that, just to so that you raise your voice and that you know, and that so that people fighting for change in those countries know that they have an ally. They don't want the Iraq model. And if anything, Iraq has given a bad name to democracy because the rulers in that area are saying, you want democracy? That's what it looks like. And people in that region have no experience, and the era of satellite television is relatively new. So, you know, they believe it, and they think, well, no, we don't want democracy. We're fine with the system that we have. But for those people that are working for change in the Gulf, and, you know, Bahrain has been a disappointment because they said that they were going to have free parliamentary elections, and then they gerrymandered the election districts so the Sunni would have a greater number than the Shiite majority. And, you know, it goes on and on. We could go down the whole list of the regression over the years. But I think what the United States could do is stick to its principles in terms of speaking up for the little guy and not interfering directly, but just making sure that they know that they have support when they get in trouble.
Dr. Bale, as a follow-up to that question, what kind of effect would U.S. efforts in working with moderate factions in those countries in the Middle East, namely the Gulf states, have an impact on defeating militant Islamic fundamentalism?
Which moderate factions are you referring to?
All the ones you want to mention.
Well, I think the real problem that we're facing now is that throughout the Middle East, we have authoritarian regimes of one type or another, which have been there for a long time. Whether they're monarchies, whether they're so-called controlled democracies, which are basically gerrymandered democracies, whether they're revolutionary nationalist or, groups like the Ba'ath, whether they're Islamist governments, I mean, they're all authoritarian. And I think the real problem now is there seems to be less and less people in the Middle East who really do have moderate views, who really want to have more freedom and want to have more choices and don't want to be stuck with these things. Now, having said that, I don't mean to suggest that people are happy with the regimes. People are not happy with the regimes. Most of the regimes are corrupt and authoritarian, and people aren't happy with them. But the problem is that the alternative, increasingly, to the existing corrupt authoritarian regimes is Islamist parties. And Islamist parties are theocratic totalitarian parties, in my opinion, worse than the existing regimes. And this is the real, for me, this is the real dilemma. Because the groups that seem to have the most popular support now are the theocratic parties, there are people in our government who feel that who have actually entertained covert relations with some of these groups for a long time, like the Muslim Brotherhood. In my opinion, always had disastrous blowback and disastrous consequences. I don't think we should be supporting Islamists, even when they claim to be promoting democracy, and even if they're participating in democratic political processes, because their ideology is fundamentally anti-democratic. So it's the same sort of situation where you might have communist parties and fascist parties, which are perfectly willing to participate in elections for tactical reasons so that they can get into power, but their ideologies are intrinsically anti-democratic. And that's the situation, I think, that we're facing, and I don't really know what the solution is. I mean, I wish that there was huge, massive pro-Western movements like there are in Lebanon, for example. I wish those kinds of movements were existed in other Middle Eastern countries, but I don't see them. Okay.
Let's start taking questions from the audience. Would anybody like to step up in the microphone and ask a question?
Good evening. I would like to know, just in terms of your own estimations, how long are we going to have military occupation of Iraq?
Would you like to address that question to a specific panelist? The whole panel. Let's start with Dr. Noyes.
When you say the military occupation, I think the military occupation of the type we have now, where we're involved in the city with trying to engineer the creation of a democracy, and we're fighting in some areas house to house, street to street. I think that will probably come to a conclusion. My own feeling, some people say by the end of this summer, there's going to be, if it doesn't work, if there isn't a substantial improvement in the ability of the political leaders to cooperate and suppress some of these groups that are still fighting us. Beyond that, I think we will move to very large bases, which are already in many, at least three of them are enormous bases on the outside the urban areas of Iraq. We will probably stay in one form or another for many years, unless we can see that we will have enough military capability in the area by using facilities now in Kuwait and some of the Gulf countries.
Dr. Behrouz, would you like to address the question?
No, as a historian, I usually look at the past.
I have a past question for that will reflect on the past.
I suspect it will have something to do with
Mr. McFarquhar, go ahead.
I suspect it will have something to do with the U.S. presidential vote, because ultimately domestic politics plays a huge role, probably more than it should, in American foreign policy, but that's the way decisions are made. And as we get closer to the election, if American soldiers are still involved in combat, it's going to, you know, obviously hurt the party in power. And so I would suspect that both parties will work very hard as we get into next winter to make sure that you know, that there is no combat or minimal combat.
Well, here's a bit of an unfair question to the panel. A member of the audience wrote a question to the effect that which presidential candidate may best represent the best solution for closure in Iraq?
I have an answer to that. None.
I have an answer.
Yes, Dr. Behrouz. That was Dr. Bale, Dr. Behrouz.
The candidate which realistically looks at the Middle East and attempts to tackle the problem of Palestinians, Iraq, and Afghanistan as urgent problems that need to be addressed and discussed and open a political process for each of them and push for them. Only, you know, if you look at the Baker report, it basically talks about the same thing, that these are interrelated with each other. And only if these issues are addressed can a solution be kind of gradually developed. So that candidate, who would that candidate be? You're asking me. I don't know. I'm an independent, so I don't even get involved in the primaries. But my hope is a realistic candidate. We all also need, you know, we're talking about terrorism. I just want to add one more point. We're talking about how you answer, respond to terrorism. Have you noticed that in Iraq, on a monthly basis, 80 to 100 people, most of them young people, blow themselves up? Aren't we to ask the question, what is going on? What is going on? What state of mind these people are in that they give up on their future and just in order to destroy somebody else's future? They do this, and it seems to be an inexhaustible source of these people. There is no end to this. And this must be a very critical psychological situation in the region in terms of hope, in terms of future, and in terms of the need to do this. A president who answers this, I think, in a realistic manner, will be the person, hopefully will be the person who...
Thank you, Dr. Behrouz. We have a member of the audience who'd like to ask a question. Go ahead, sir.
This is Mr. Farquhar. You spoke of the regression of democracy and gave an example, one party putting in conditions that were unfair to the other party as far as being a representative vote. How would you distinguish that from politics in the United States?
You can be cynical about the U.S. system, but it's sort of a self-righting system in that we do have, a working press, and we do have two opposition parties. And, yeah, I mean, everybody tries to gerrymander their own districts, but when you're just starting out, they had no parliament in Bahrain since 1975, and they're just, you know, trying to already use the parliament to assure that, you know, one, the Sunni minority keeps control of the island and doesn't give the Shiite majority a voice commensurate with their numbers, then they're already going to see the system as flawed and undemocratic. I mean, I think in the United States, you're building on a fairly strong foundation, and we have a constitution that protects, and, you know, we have elections every 4 years, and you're assured of them, at least until now we are. And or every 2 years in terms of congressional districts. So I think that there are safeguards built into the American system that in these, you know, countries that have no tradition of democracy at all just don't exist.
Thank you, Mr. Mfarquhar. Any other members of the audience that would like to step up to the microphone and ask a question? Yes, sir.
The Democratic Congress has recently surfaced a plan to disengage from Iraq. I believe the time frame is May of 2008. I would like from each of you panel members to tell us your assessment of the consequences to Iraq, to the Middle East, and to this country if, in fact, that plan is implemented.
Dr. Noyes, would you like to start out?
I think a timetable would be a disaster, except within the confines of our own government, but not announced. I don't think it's that kind of a war, that kind of a situation. It's the whole war was a masterpiece of unintended consequences, and we have created, you know, in very simple terms, a democracy that we're trying to produce meant a Shia majority. This, in turn, multiplied the power of Iran tenfold, psychologically, politically, and every other way, because they're a Shia state. And we are now confronting a horrendous political dilemma, trying to forge ahead and produce that, still trying to forge ahead and produce that Shia state, which is extremely upsetting to our Sunni Arab allies, upon whom the Saudis, the small Gulf states, Egypt, Jordan, the countries that we are now going to need very seriously to help us surround and ameliorate the whole problem of Iraq. So we're in a situation that we cannot walk out of. And the to set a timetable would mean they could save their forces, their ammunition, their whatever, until that time comes and then let loose. We have simply got to remain. They have the Iraqi, all the insurgents, the militias, what have you, they have no aircraft, they have no logistic capability, they have no ability to protect the country or to manage it, basically, on their own. So I think we have to hang in there and not make it easier for the forces that want to continue chaos.
Dr. Beirouz?
I think without a political process, if the United States leaves, there will be open civil war, which is going to continue for a long time, and the U.S. will have to get involved again at some point. So just leaving after creating a mess, let's put it this way, would not only be irresponsible, in my opinion, but it would be catastrophic for the region. Perhaps if pressure is to be exerted, it's not to withdraw, but to start a viable political process by providing a political context so that the civil war can come to an end. And what is that political context? Sunnis have been disempowered by the United States. Since 1921, they have been the power, ruling power in Iraq when the country was created. Now they have been disempowered. They need assurances. The Arab world has always been ruled by Sunnis. This is the first time in modern times that a Shia Arab country is being created thanks to the United States. They are worried. The Shias are worried that the Sunnis will come back and will put them as in a position of underdog again. So they need to be provided assurances. Iran is worried that the United States is going to attack it. Syria is worried. So you have to bring all of this together in conferences, in international auspices, so that they can discuss things with each other, so that the reasons for civil war, the political reasons behind the civil war, can be removed. I surely think that there are those who will never be convinced. They need to be isolated in order to be eliminated at some point in the future. But to think that there is a short-term military solution to Iraq, and that if that solution is not reached, the United States can simply withdraw from Iraq, I think is a bit short-sighted from whatever direction it comes. In Vietnam, when the United States pulled out, there was a strong, robust government called Democratic Republic of Vietnam, which immediately filled the vacuum and created stability after the U.S. government left, U.S. forces left, and the South Vietnamese government collapsed. In Iraq, there is no immediate government in the vicinity or in the country to fill the vacuum. If the United States just pulls out, what you will have is a Mogadishu type or Afghanistan type of vacuum, where different factions control different districts of Baghdad or the country, and the civil war will come into open involving the neighbors of Iraq. It's going to be catastrophic.
Thank you, Dr. Bebrouz. Dr. Bale?
Well, I think that if you want to talk about timetables, the time to be talking about timetables for withdrawal is when you're operating from a position of strength. And, in fact, one of the complaints that I had all along about our public stance in Iraq from the time that the regime collapsed was that the smart policy right away would have been to be conveying the message to the Iraqis every single day that we want to leave, we're anxious to leave, because their perception was that this was sort of like some kind of neo-colonial venture, and we were just going to hunker down and occupy a Muslim country in perpetuity. And there may have been a few people in the administration who had that same idea. But the fact is that the smart strategy at that particular juncture would have been to say, look, we don't want to occupy Iraq. Quite the contrary. We got rid of Saddam to give you an opportunity to create a better society and to change the geopolitical balance in the Middle East. But instead, we didn't send that message to anybody, and we appeared more and more like a foreign occupier. So now we're in the predicament where the situation is degenerated into a sectarian strife and civil war and on top of the insurgency. And if we withdraw anytime soon, it's going to be perceived by our enemies as a sign of weakness. I mean, certainly the jihadists, just as they believe that they alone defeated the Soviets thanks to the will of Allah, forgetting, of course, that they were getting massive aid from the United States and the ISI, the Pakistani Secret Service, which enabled them to actually continue fighting until the Soviets gave up. The jihadists and the Islamists in Iraq are going to be crowing on their websites that they defeated the other superpower and gain a lot of prestige. So if we leave now in a precipitous fashion, we're going to definitely give our enemies a lot of propaganda ammunition. On the other hand, there's no point in staying in perpetuity if we're not actually taking actions which are going to improve the situation by putting pressure on all the parties to really come to a political solution. The final point I want to make, though, is that the Iraqis have to take some responsibility here as well. You know, sure, the United States made lots of mistakes, but, you know, the Iraqis didn't step up to the plate. We gave them an opportunity to create a better society. Now, we didn't take into consideration that 30 years of dictatorship, traumatized population, and so forth and so on. But at some point, the Iraqis could have said, look, you know, we have a chance now to make a better society. We can bury the hatchet. We can extend the olive branch to other groups and factions within our country, form a new government that represents everybody in some degree. And they could have ended up with creating a much better society for themselves if they'd really put a lot of energy into that, but they didn't do that. They didn't do what they should have done either. So there's a lot of blame to go around, both in terms of our policy and in terms of the behavior of the Iraqis, or at least elements within Iraq that came to leadership positions who really squandered opportunities that we provided them.
Mr. Farquhar.
I would just sort of also emphasize, to build on what my two previous colleagues said, to emphasize the regional angle. And I think if the U.S. as emotionally satisfying as it would be to say, let's bring the soldiers home and, you know, they can sort out their own mess, it would splinter. And, you know, if the Kurds declared an independent state, you know, the Turkish army would invade to prevent that because they don't want their Kurds to get any ideas about independence. And the Iranians would probably support that. And the Iranians would also intervene, you know, to protect the Shiite government because it's in their interest to have their co-religionists next door, even if they don't always agree on terms of the forms of government. And then the Sunnis would probably create a rump state, which would be exactly the same conditions that brought the Taliban to power in Afghanistan. So you really can't withdraw precipitously before you ensure that that isn't going to happen. And I think one of the beauties of the Baker-Hamilton plan is what they did put an emphasis on, sort of less is more in terms of trying to engage the neighbors and get the neighbors all talking to each other so that they agree with a plan, and so that they're, you know, because it's in everyone's interest in the neighborhood that it returns to stability. And so if they can get everyone in the neighborhood to agree and to police that, then the U.S. can diminish its role.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a town hall meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our subject is the United States' future in Iraq and the Middle East. Our panelists tonight are Dr. James Noyes of the Hoover Institute, Dr. Mazir Behrouz of San Francisco State University, Dr. Jeffrey Bale of the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and Neil McFarquhar of the New York Times. I've received several written questions from the audience regarding the notion of partitioning Iraq along ethnic lines as a solution to the problems in Iraq. Which panelist would like to take that one? Dr. Behrouz.
It's a very difficult notion because, first of all, what will happen, a lot of ethnic cleansing will have to occur. Because many parts of Iraq, let's say Baghdad, they're mixed. If you want to divide Baghdad into ethnic groups, you have to have walls inside Baghdad or ethnic cleansing. That is to say, part of the population cleans the other part of the population out, which is kind of to a degree is happening right now, but it's going to accelerate. if the country is partitioned, the Sunni parts will be left without any oil, without access to open sea, and in a relatively poor part of the country, which will give them all the incentive to continue the war. So dividing the country and then giving the poorest part of the country to the ones who were ruling the country since its creation would give them the best incentive to continue this, to fight. And the civil war will not end. That will not solve the issue. Dividing Iraq, a British-made country, by the way, into viable segments may, in the end, be a solution. But it must come from within Iraq and by the Iraqis, and not imposed by outsiders. The outsiders imposed on the Arab world the borders that you see today, and we have been living with that ever since. The outside world should take a back seat, provide support and protection and security, and the context where Iraqis can sit, assure each other to either live in one country or to divide it into three in a friendly manner.
Dr. Noyes, do you have an opinion on Iraq partition?
I agree that it doesn't sort itself out geographically well. And we haven't talked about the humanitarian crisis in the country that's already there. There are, I don't know how many 100,000 people have been uprooted and Iraqis are refugees within their own country. There's something like 1 million that have fled to Jordan, to Syria, to other parts. These people were often the ones who were the most educated, the doctors, the lawyers.
They're probably coming over to California.
But they've lost many of their most talented, educated, sophisticated people. But the partition I think if that's eventually decided upon by them, would be a possible federalized solution or total, but it would be very, very difficult to engineer from the standpoint of anyone outside the country.
Thank you. Ma'am, you had a question. A member of the audience is approaching the microphone with a question. Thank you.
Yes. I think from before day one, the Iraqi war was criminal, and I think it's criminal today. And I have a feeling that maybe we should ask our friends in the world, in the Arab world and in the Western world, to help us come to a political solution. And I would vote 10 times for Hillary Clinton if I could. So, I'm not a lefty.
But ma'am, do you have a question for the panel?
I'd like to hear what they think about
to
that.
To respond to your...
Yes, statement.
Your opinion, okay.
Yes, my opinion.
Mr. Mifarquhar.
I mean, it's unfortunate that process didn't happen in the first place. I think now that we've created this enormous mess, it's like, gee, there's kind of a mess in the kitchen. Would someone else please go clean it up? And to do that, I think the United States would have to relinquish a certain amount of control, which they've always been reluctant to do. And I think probably the place to start, as I had said previously, was in the neighborhood, is that you sort of get the neighbors to agree on a plan, and then... you know, maybe you can get others. But I think that the day is long past when you'll get any, you know, significant power to, I mean, who would send troops into a situation like that? I mean, I think it's unrealistic to try and stabilize it.
Yeah. Forgive me, my thought was that it should be a political solution rather than a military one.
It's true, but you have to do something about you have to do something to stabilize the country. You have to do something to get that insurgency to stop.
You've got to provide at least a minimal degree of security.
Dr. Bale.
You have to provide at least a minimal degree of security to really make progress, because as long as there's the kind of levels of violence, sectarian and otherwise, that are going on, it really makes it extremely difficult for people to sit down at a table who have lots of real grievances with each other and actually come to some kind of negotiated solution when people are blowing each other up or kidnapping people and putting drill bits in their head. I mean, that's not exactly a conducive environment for negotiation. And there are contexts. I mean, we all would agree that, you know, if you can negotiate, if you can come to a political solution, fine. But there are some times when certain parties or extremists and so forth make that impossible, and you have to eliminate them or neutralize them one way or the other. So...
Here's an interesting question from the audience, a written question. Are any true leaders of each sect interested in money? How about $25 billion for each sect to be paid on certain criteria being accomplished? Money may still have some interest for their various interests. Does anybody have a response to that from the panel?
Who's going to pay that money?
Okay, Dr. Beirut.
And who's going to receive it?
I am already paying one-third of my income in taxes. Are we going to be taxed further to pay for that? Where is the money going to come from? That's the first question. We can talk about your spending later.
Dr. Noyes.
I
think the part of the answer to that is there are billions at their fingertips right now. If they could get the oil production going, have enough order in the country, they all know this. If they could bring order, if they had it within their power, they would do so, and they would generate hundreds of millions of dollars in increased oil production that could be distributed fairly if they could reach an agreement to do so. But they don't have the power to control the insurgency or the emotions of the sectarian emotions, putting aside the violent insurgency encouraged by outsiders.
Dr. Bale.
Well, I just want to say that the biggest problem we're facing over there is ideological extremism and various types. But of the types of ideological extremism we're dealing with, the religious version is the worst of all. And, you know, these people are not operating in accordance with the same parameters of people in Western society, just as we have religious extremists in our own country who are thinking about, wow, I wish the end of the world would come tomorrow so I could be raptured. You know, those are people who have a completely different mental framework than people like like the rest of us greedy capitalists, quote-unquote, or whatever you want to call us, those of us who are concerned about mundane, practical, pragmatic matters, I mean, these people are not thinking in those terms. I mean, it's not to say that they, as human beings, they always, that's another dimension to their behavior, but they are really living in a religious context. I mean, that's the context that they're operating in. And I mean, look, if we could simply solve the problem by giving people money, then we could have easily, somebody would have turned in bin Laden by now. We have had a $25 million reward on his head. We had rewards on Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's head. We have rewards on out for Zawahiri, and nobody, even in very poor regions of the world, has stepped forward to turn these people in. So that tells you something right there, that money is not the thing which drives everybody in the world, even if it may be the thing which tends to drive a lot of people in this country or in the West.
Are there other members in the audience who would like to ask a question? Yes, ma'am.
Well, you've presented a compelling argument as to what would happen if we did leave Iraq precipitously, and I understand that. But I guess you haven't convinced me yet as to what would be different or what would change if we stayed. What would the benchmarks be? How would we accomplish it? How long? I mean, I know those are open-ended questions, but on the other hand, we don't have an open-ended army.
Dr. Bale.
Well, I think, again, I think we've all more or less agreed that there has to be a political solution, and a political solution can only be achieved if enormous pressure is put by us on various parties in Iraq to behave sensibly. And also on the neighbor, on some of the neighboring countries. I mean, like when people are talking about being concerned about the role of the Saudis. I mean, look, the sad reality is that the worst supporters of jihadist terrorism are our so-called allies, the Saudis and the Pakistanis, or elements within those societies. So the idea that we should necessarily be looking to the Saudis, you know, one of the most reactionary, horrible regimes and societies as some kind of to provide a solution in Iraq is not necessarily the way to go. I mean, one of the things that I consider to be the greatest tragedy is the migrations or the refugees. All of these, there's the Iraqi professional class has basically left Iraq, and these are the people who are primarily secular. Iraq was primarily a secular society. And you've got all the educated professionals and people who have a secular orientation. They're leaving because they're being targeted by Shia death squads. They're being targeted by Sunni death squads. And so the religious fanatics on all sides seem to be the ones who are coming to the fore and taking over. And we're actually supporting some of them with the Shia parties. So, I mean, this is the real tragedy. After 9/11... the enemy is radical Islam. There's no doubt about it. In particular, jihadist networks, and these are the groups that we need to eliminate, and we need to do it in an intelligent, targeted, precise way to avoid radicalizing millions of other Muslims in the process. But the worst thing you can do in a situation when your enemy is the Islamist, the radical Islamist, is to be going around destabilizing and undermining secular regimes in the Middle East, like the Ba'athist regime in Iraq and the Ba'athist regime in Syria. I mean, if the Syrian regime collapses, the Islamists are going to probably fill the political void there as well. Then we're going to have a much worse situation than we have now. So I guess you wanted a solution. I guess I'm just mentioning more problems. So I.
Thank you. I've received written questions regarding Israel. So here's a question. What can or should we do with respect to our relationship with Israel that may positively impact our policy toward the Middle East as far as our long-term national security objectives? Dr. Beirut.
If I can point to one single element that cuts across the board on social classes in the Middle East, that causes a lot of resentment in the Middle East among different groups of people and social classes, is the Palestinian issue. Unless this issue is addressed, unless this occupation of this small territory of a very small country, Israel is very small, Palestinian territories are even smaller, but the issue itself is big, very big. And it's not just religious. It goes to middle class. It goes to the upper class. It goes to the educated. It goes to the secular people. Everybody is angry about the situation. Unless this is addressed, I think, Not Iraq, not Afghanistan, not Islamic terrorism, not Islamic fundamentalism, none of them will be properly answered and therefore neutralized. This issue has to be answered. And the United States, under the previous administration, when it got engaged in the issue, it made headway. When it was involved, it provided direction. It needed push and shove. It engaged both parties. And it provided a framework. So the U.S. engagement in the issue, we know by our only recent history, has been very positive. Conversely, the U.S. disengagement from the issue has been very non-constructive. And there has been no steps taken forward since this administration came in. So the U.S. needs to stay involved in the Middle East issue, particularly the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, particularly working toward ending the Palestinian occupation. It has no more reason to continue.
Thank you. Dr. Bale?
Well, I'd just like to make one cautionary remark regarding that. Resolving some of these legitimate grievances in the Muslim world is very important if we want to eliminate the support base of the of Al Qaeda and other jihadist networks. However, one should never delude oneself that if we were to actually solve various existing problems in the Middle East, that we would somehow get the jihadists to like us, because they're going to hate us no matter what we do. They have a delusional ideology, and it's intrinsically hostile to everything in the West. And they're just going to keep on keeping on no matter what we do. So any policies we adopt are not going to affect the attitudes of the ideological vanguards that are trying to mobilize the Muslim masses and are engaged in carrying out acts of terrorism. Having said that, if we're able to address legitimate grievances in various parts of the Muslim world, we can dramatically reduce the amount of popular support that these ideological vanguards are able to obtain and mobilize. And I think that's so. In that sense, it is actually a very important component of a successful war against against jihadist terrorist networks.
Mr. McFarquhar,
I think you can also sort of see a pattern. I mean, because the 1967 war under which the Palestinian territories were occupied was kind of the watershed in the Middle Eastern political movements, because it's at that point that people lost their faith, sort of started to lose their faith in the secular regimes and in the Arab nationalism, and started looking towards other solutions. And the Islamist radical movements have grown and grown and grown since that day. And by not solving the problem of that conflict, it's become sort of the poster for the radicalization. And if you look, I mean, Palestinian society used to be fairly middle class, well-educated, committed to education. And, even up through I was living in Jerusalem in 1993 when that peace, the Oslo Peace Accords came through, and there was just this tremendous relief on the Palestinian street and on the Israeli street too, that they were finally going to find a solution, and the Palestinians thought that they would get the Israeli army out of their lives, and the Israeli people thought that they would not have the threat of violence directed against them in their streets and buses and cafes, and it all kind of fell apart, and now you can see as it falls apart that the Palestinian street gets increasingly radicalized. Anybody middle class or secular tries to come here or emigrate, and the Israelis try and rely on solutions like building walls that are really are a short term solution and aren't going to create any long term security for them in the region. So again, that's why the United States needs to be engaged and try and make progress and knock heads together if you need to, but just to do something so that people feel like there's a solution in the offing, or at least someone's attempting to make a solution there.
Thank you. Do we have any other members in the audience who would like to ask a question? At the microphone. Yes, sir.
Follow up to what the discussion's been. Let's assume that the Israelis and the Palestinians shook hands and were very peaceful in the future. Do you think that would in any way change the fact that the Iraqi Shiites and Sunnis would automatically start shaking hands?
Dr. Bale.
No. Look, one of the things that we can talk about is, the Palestinian issue is like an open sore psychologically to Muslims. In other words, it's like a constant reminder of their humiliation and their weakness and so forth and so on. So it's an ongoing psychological irritant. But the fact of the matter is that there are numerous other problems and issues locally, nationally, and regionally that are really of much more, much greater concern to people in that area. And therefore, even if the Israelis and Palestinians could shake hands and come to some kind of amicable agreement, it really wouldn't change the fact that there are intractable problems. For example, in Iraq and in some intractable problems in Afghanistan and places like that. So I don't think it's the magic bullet that's going to solve all the ethnic and religious and political conflicts that are existing throughout the Middle East. And one more point needs to be mentioned about this thing is that the Israeli Palestinian issue has been exploited by every Muslim government as a way of gaining legitimacy, but what have they really done to actually help the situation? What have they actually done to actually ameliorate the condition of the Palestinians, improve the condition of the Palestinians, put pressure on both parties, in both the Palestinians and the Israelis to actually achieve a solution? It's almost like many of the regimes in the Middle East don't want to have a solution. They want this to be an ongoing festering sore that they can exploit for propaganda purposes.
Thank you, Dr. Bale. This brings our program tonight to a close. Our thanks to panelists Dr. James Noyes of the Hoover Institute, Dr. Mazir Behrouz of San Francisco State University, Dr. Jeffrey Bale of the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and Neil McFarquhar of the New York Times. I'm Michael Brandis. We also thank our audience here as well as our radio audience. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 104th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Is that early? Is it too early?